from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies. It's Thursday, the 13th of October, and this is Game On. Coming up today, another day, another super sub. Tony O'Donoghue and Fergal Brennan reflect on a dramatic week for football.
Here they come again. Jotter has given it to Salah. Who scored another? He scored a hat-trick. A quick-fire Mo Salah hat-trick at Ibrox. Left foot whip across McGregor into the far corner, and he scored 3 goals in 5 minutes. A hat-trick in 5 minutes at Ibrox for Mo Salah after coming on as a substitute.
In rugby, Bernard Jackman sets us up for Connacht versus Leinster and the rest of the URC action. Plus, we'll ask what next for Wasps as the English rugby crisis continues.
They effectively admitted that they'd run out of both time and money and that it was likely they would go into administration in the next few days. And if they do suffer that fate, they may face automatic relegation. They are the Premiership's rules, and they'd be the second club in just 2 weeks to suffer that fate after Worcester Warriors. There's serious questions now being asked about the governance, the sustainability and the finances of Premiership club rugby.
In racing, Jane Mangan sets us up for the weekend a day early, and sprinter Charlene Mosley talks about resilience in relay running. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Welcome along. Bernard Jackman is with me in studio. Bernard, as we heard there in the intro, it is a bit of a tricky time for rugby. Wasps have been suspended from the Premiership and set to enter administration within days. And they are, of course, the second club in a matter of weeks after Worcester Warriors also suffered that fate. What is happening?
Well, the scary thing is it mightn't end here. There's rumours there's another 2 clubs on the brink as well, which would, you know, if, look at even to lose 2 clubs, you know, in the course of a couple of weeks, clubs with history, particularly Wasps, obviously, you know, we in Ireland remember them well from their European Cup games, and particularly, you know, against Munster and you know, Wonder Warren Gatland, Sean Edwards, they were very, very successful in Europe. So this has been coming for a while. They basically moved out of London because they felt there was too much competition there. They moved to Coventry, took on a big stadium. At the time, it was being touted as being the way forward for rugby clubs to go take a soccer stadium. There's a casino, there was a conference centre, it was going to be a kind of 52 weeks of the year venue. And they took a bond, they financed a bond to do the deal, and that, they haven't been able to refinance it, basically. And COVID has probably brought all this to a head, but it's not the only reason. All these clubs got significant government funding during COVID. Okay, it's a loan that they got to pay back, but they've been living beyond their means. And even that's in the face of the fact that the salary cap has started to drop over the last couple of years in the UK, or in the Premiership. So it's a sad day. I've got some friends in Wasps, I've got some friends in Worcester, and to be scrambling now for contracts at a time when a lot of other clubs are either at the max in the salary cap or under their own financial pressures is not ideal. And, you know, people think, oh, go to France. That's not easy. France is closed now. You can only get into France as a medical joker. Some of those contracts are only 3 months, and basically those players are going to be waiting now for an injury in France to potentially go there. Obviously the cream of the crop will get signed up. I'd be interested in John Ryan's situation. John Ryan, a Munster prop, Ireland international tight head. And theoretically he's going to be out of work, you know, next week if things go to plan. Would Munster bring him back? I think they're a little bit light at tight head. I'd hate to see any player or any coach you know, be in a situation like they're in. But the game at the moment, particularly those English clubs, there's a big reset happening, and they're going to have to find a way of making it sustainable.
Okay, we're going to get into that in more detail a little bit later on. We're going to turn our attention to football now, though. Shamrock Rovers are looking for their first win in the Europa Conference League group stages this evening. They take on Mulday in Talla Stadium, and Tony O'Donoghue is there for us. Tony, how are they going to approach this game, do you think?
Well, it has to go better for them than the away game, doesn't it? Because that was actually a bit of a disaster. They were conceded early again, as they have done in all their away games. And they were resting players as well, which many people saw as a very strange decision. I mean, considering that getting into Europe is the holy grail, it is certainly for the money. But, you know, the game should be about glory as well. But they were resting players with a view to that important league game against Shelburne. And they ended up losing 3-0. But their home form has been excellent, both in the League of Ireland and in Europe. They haven't lost a game in any competition in Tala since going down to Flora Tallinn in August 2021. So that's an impressive 31-game unbeaten run. Now, they do have a point in the Europa Conference League, that early draw with Ur Gardens, and that was the opening game. And they have beaten Ferencváros of Hungary and Ludogorets of Bulgaria earlier in European competition this season. So if they were to manage a win tonight against an impressive Molde side, that would be worth €500,000 to them extra, as well as putting them back in the mix really to qualify. But, you know, a draw, by the way, worth €166,000. So there is plenty at stake this evening, no question about that. Andy Lowndes is a doubt. Haven't got team news a little bit early yet. Adam Oemaku has recovered from an ankle injury. He's fit to start. And great news for Rovers, Roberto Lopez has recovered. He missed 17 matches because of his medial knee ligament injury, but he should certainly be ready to take his place in the centre of the Rovers' defence, and hopefully that'll mean that they don't concede silly early goals, as they have done, as I say, against good quality opposition already this season.
Yeah, and Tony, just from your point of view, you've been covering so many teams in Europe over the years. Their decision to maybe focus on that Shelburne game at the weekend, do you think that was the right thing to do? Obviously, they won that and, you know, they're trying to get their hands on the league, but European nights are so special and so rare, and for some players are the best nights of their lives, and they didn't get to play.
But you see, what we do want is not the irregular, it's a great night and let's have a great time.
Speak for yourself now, Tony. I do like those nights.
what I think we want, what Shamrock Rovers and what the League of Ireland wants, is consistency. Mm-hmm. We want to be playing at this level all the time. But I suppose the corollary of that is, you know, familiarity can breed contempt as well. I mean, if Shamrock Rovers are to, I guess, disrespect the competition in a way, it may not be long before the fans think likewise and may feel that a Sunday game against Shelburne is worth the admission fee rather than a Thursday night game against Molde. Because, yeah, you're absolutely right, European competition, it's a higher level. Mm-hmm. But from a Shamrock Rovers financial point of view, they have to. And also for the sake of the champions' path to get them to this far, to get them as far as group stages, they have to win the League of Ireland here. And obviously with Derry breathing down their neck, that Shelburne game became absolutely huge, which is why the likes of Jack Byrne or Rory Gaffney or Graham Burke ended up starting on the bench in Norway last week.
Yeah, I'd say when that final goal went in on Sunday afternoon, it was a distant memory, that European game last week, and they were just so delighted to get that win. Look, sure, we might get a bit of team news before the hour is over.
Absolutely, but
We'll check back in with you. But there is a lot of other news as well, Tony. So,
but there sure is.
I can't believe we're going to be sitting here now and I'm going to say these words. Vera Powell's team will be in pot three for the draw for the Women's World Cup.
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it?
It's amazing.
The seedings were confirmed today with the release of the latest FIFA rankings. And, you know, more good news for Ireland, really. They've got a new high position. They climb up two places to 24th, up from 26th, which is brilliant. USA, the world champions, remain top. Sweden, who were in our group and who, remember, only beat Ireland very narrowly here in Tala, and Ireland were very, very good that day. And then Ireland went and to Gothenburg and drew away, which is one of the many good away performances by the Republic of Ireland women in qualifying. Well, Sweden are back to second on today's FIFA rankings. Germany go down to third. And the Euro 2020 winners and no doubt a very, very good capable side, England, remain fourth. So, as I say, the current rankings were used for the draw. Ireland are in pot three, 29 teams left. We're not one of the three, thankfully, that have to go to that Inter-Confederations tournament.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But when you look at the pots now as they are, and you're thinking already, like, we no longer have to dream. We're talking about the draw, and we hope it won't be as tough as Stephen Kenny's Euro 2024 draw. But you look at pot one now, USA, Germany, Sweden, England, France, Spain, a lot of the European countries, of course. But they also have the two host countries. New Zealand will be placed in position A1, and Australia will be positioned in position B2. Now, New Zealand, in today's rankings, are ranked 22 in the world. So we're ranked 24th. And even though they may be one of the host nations, I think that's the one that we'd like to come out of pot one to be paired with the Republic of Ireland, because that would give us a great chance, or even Australia. And maybe we'll be the ones looking at the likes of Sweden and saying, no, we're capable of going toe-to-toe with them. I would hate early in the competition. I'd prefer to meet the USA in, you know, maybe the quarterfinal or the semifinal, or Germany or France, yeah, or England, to be fair, or even Spain. And then you look at pot two: Canada, Netherlands, Brazil, Japan, Norway, Italy, China, South Korea. Again, the European teams will be strong there: Norway, Netherlands. Maybe Italy might be okay. But maybe we'll think about a Japan or a China in that one. And then we're one of the teams in pot three. Pot four, the ones to avoid here will be the ones who come through. And I'm sure, with respect to the other nations, that it'll probably be the European teams who'll come through from that Inter-Confederations tournament. So it's Switzerland or Portugal we want to avoid there, or the other playoff winner. So, you know, take your pick from Nigeria, Philippines, South Africa, Morocco, Zambia. But it's exciting, isn't it? It's real now, and we can look at the countries and we can think of our dream draw and our nightmare draw. But it's going to happen.
How many months, Tony, do we have to talk about this?
We'll be talking about it for a long time, that's for sure.
Tony, I know journalists never like being the story, but that was a lovely moment between yourself and Vera Powell after the game. And you've been following this team for so long, and you've seen the bad days and the good days and the highs and the lows. And, you know, it's not like you weren't asking the hard questions, or that you weren't, you know, doing your job to such a level. But it just showed the respect that they had for you, that they included you and gave you that jersey. And you could see how much it meant to them that you were there.
It was a wonderful moment for me personally, and I was mortified. I was certainly surprised. I was not expecting that at all, and it kind of took me aback. All right, I wasn't sure what she was doing, but gosh, it's lovely. It's such a nice gesture, but I'm kind of not surprised in some ways, because I think Vera has shown, and I'm sure we'll talk about it as well, but with the video issue and what happened in the dressing room, that she's shown great leadership. She's shown great management in the way she's kind of, you know, took it straight on. She's come out with the apology quickly, and she said it's all about respect, and the respect that they have as a team and as a squad, and the respect that she's shown, and she and the team have shown to me with that. I mean, I've never done this before, by the way, and I have a lot of favourite teams. Cork City might be one of them. Tottenham Hotspur might be one, but I've never framed a jersey before. But I'm definitely doing this one, because it was on a very special night, and there'll never be another first time when the Republic of Ireland qualify for a World Cup. It was a lovely gesture, I have to say.
Look, I just want to make the point as well that the way that she has handled herself in everything over the last few years, a lot of other managers who have gone before her, not saying the Irish women's managers, but other managers, could have learned an awful lot from the way she's been able to handle every situation she's been in, because there was times when they weren't winning and there was questions asked about her and her methods and her plans, but she always treated everybody with respect and answered the hard questions, and is able to show that warmth and charisma when she needs to as well. I have a lot of respect for her myself too. She's been
That series of games when we took on better class opposition, which made us better, which made us harder to beat, which actually honed our ability to manage games. If we hadn't done that, you know, who knows whether we might have qualified, we may not have qualified, but doing that was really important, and it was not the popular thing to do. And if you look at it in the context or in comparison with Stephen Kenny, and when he was going through difficult results, the pressure on him was enormous, and you wonder, could I just get one game against an opposition that I can actually beat and take some of this pressure off? But no, she was certain of her plan. And she made her players certain that it was the right game plan. And so that's what she did. And, you know, you have to take your hat off to her. Fair play.
Absolutely, yeah. And she always fronts up. She's great. It's a tricky time for them as well, though. We've seen now that UEFA have opened an investigation after what happened in the dressing room after the game, after that World Cup playoff victory over Scotland. What does this mean for them now, Tony?
Well, the investigation has to take its course. It's for potential inappropriate behaviour in the aftermath of the 2023 Women's World Cup, and a UEFA Ethics and Disciplinary Inspector will be appointed. I did ask for clarification from UEFA myself today. I inquired about the name of the inspector or the inspectors or the terms of reference for this, but UEFA told me they don't make any comment regarding open disciplinary investigations. But I did have a look at the various UEFA statutes, etc., and the executive committee appoints the ethics and disciplinary inspectors for a term of 4 years, and there's one designated chief inspector. The chairman of that is Thomas Partl from Austria, and there's two vice chairmen, Jim Stern Hansen of Denmark and Sander Berze from Hungary. And then there are 13 other members, among them Bobby Barnes of England, Neil Doncaster of Scotland, and Áine Power of Ireland. Now, she's might be known to some people in some of the Game On audience. She's an Irish lawyer. She has a master's in sports management from the International Centre for Sports Studies. She's worked in international sports law since 2011. She's the deputy legal director of the International Equestrian Federation, based in Switzerland, and she joined the Disciplinary and Ethics Committee in 2020. I think it was in June in 2020. Whether she might feel she has to recuse herself from this particular investigation because Ireland are involved, I'm not sure. But that's the process. The disciplinary body may commission the ethics and disciplinary inspectors to conduct investigations either alone or in cooperation with other UEFA or non-UEFA bodies, and such investigations will be written inquiries and, where necessary, the questioning of individuals, and they can also request documents or evidence, video evidence, etc. So, look, the way VIRA and the FAI have fronted up, once again, they again apologised, the FAI, when that UEFA investigation was confirmed. They said they'll continue to review the situation accordingly to ensure international players and staff are aware of their responsibilities. I think they've dealt with it absolutely fine as best they can. They've accepted the singing was inappropriate. Vera has spoken about respect, even in private. She said you can't do that. So if there are to be any sanctions, I think if the FAI are to remain consistent with the way they've handled this, I think they'll accept those sanctions. But hopefully, if they are, they won't be personalised, and I hope they'll be very small if they are.
Okay, well, you'll be across that, no doubt, as well, Tony. And just before we finish up, there are two FAI Cup semi-finals this weekend as well: Derry City versus Treaty United, and Waterford FC and Shelburne. Two very exciting clashes.
Yeah, Premier Division against First Division opposition in both, although Derry, with the home advantage as well, will be expected to do the business against Treaty United. And Derry, as I say, in great form. They were putting the pressure on Shamrock Rovers in the league. Michael Duffy is back. Patrick McElhenney is back to his best. That's going to be difficult. The other game, Waterford have the home advantage, and they've had a good run in the cup, and they've got the SSE Soccer Writers Player of the Month, Phoenix Patterson, who's a dead ball specialist. And Shelburne, Damien Duff Shelburne, have to go down there. I'm sure they'll be well motivated, but that'll be a trickier tie, I think. That'll be more difficult. Hard to say who's going to come out in that one. Derry at this point will be favourites to lift the trophy, and maybe that will put them on their way to challenging Shamrock Rovers for the league in the season ahead, and to maybe do what Shamrock Rovers have done, and before them Dundalk, and before them Cork City, and make it to the group stages of European competition. Although Cork didn't make it to group stages, but make it to European competition. And hopefully Shamrock Rovers this evening can do what they've done at home, and certainly put Mulday to the pin of their collar, and maybe get a decent result. There's a lot of money riding on it as well.
Okay, Tony, thank you so much, and sure, you might get back in touch with us if you have any team news, but it is a while away yet. Thank you. We'll talk to you very, very soon, Tony. Now we are going to turn our attention to football across the water, and I'm delighted to say that Fergal Brennan is with me now on the line. Fergal, we were listening to the intro of the show, and Mo Salah's hat-trick was the commentary. The big question is, though, is he back?
Liverpool fans will be absolutely hoping that is the case. He only needed a little cameo off the bench last night to make his mark. Fastest ever hat-trick in the history of the Champions League. Just five and a half minutes to get it. And they absolutely swept Rangers aside, going down 1-0 early on. They fought back. And I don't think even the travelling Liverpool fans, who were maybe a little bit nervous at half-time, thought they were ever going to come unstuck against Rangers, who've been really, really poor in the Champions League this season. And as for Liverpool in Europe, it's been a bit of a release valve for them. We know in the Premier League they've not been at their best, or certainly at their most consistent. And now, short of something disastrous happening in the final two games, they should get themselves into the last 16. That'll lift a bit of weight off the shoulders of the players and Jurgen Klopp. But They've got Manchester City at the weekend, and as you say, with Mohamed Salah, hopefully, from a Liverpool perspective, he's back to form, because this is a huge, huge game, because Liverpool need a massive Premier League performance. They struggled against Arsenal last weekend, and they've struggled in quite a few Premier League games so far this season. If there's a time to turn it round, you might look at this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be hopeful, but at the same time, it was Rangers. Manchester City are going to be a completely different animal and will no doubt be so motivated to make their mark against Liverpool.
Of course, and I think on paper, you look at this Premier League form so far this season, Manchester City, despite the fact that it's at Anfield and Liverpool have only lost once at home, whilst Pep Guardiola's been City manager against them, the odds are stacked against Liverpool, which is strange when you think that they're playing at home and they are still amongst the best teams in the Premier League and in Europe. There needs to be, at some point, a Liverpool response to this start to the season. I take on board what you've been saying about Rangers, and obviously they've been pretty poor this season in the Champions League, and this was straightforward for Liverpool. But Liverpool, I've said this quite a few weeks in a row, and maybe I'm cursing Liverpool slightly, Liverpool are too good for this to go on too much longer. I'm not saying they'll beat City at the weekend. I think it'll be a really good game. I think they've got a chance of getting a draw, personally. But I don't think they'll be torn to pieces, which is what City have been doing to teams so far this season. Obviously, Erling Haaland scoring goals for fun. I think Liverpool will be able to match them for the majority of the game. Whether or not that means a positive result, obviously that remains to be seen. But I don't see this being a kind of example of how Liverpool have fallen. I think they'll get themselves back into the groove this weekend, and a draw would stabilise them, particularly when you look at how well City have been playing this season.
I'm not sure if you saw Alan Shearer's column today on the BBC website, and he feels that if Harry Kane was playing for Manchester City, that he'd be scoring pretty much the same amount of goals as Haaland.
I probably wouldn't go that far. I do think Harry Kane is a very good player, and he's a consistent Premier League goal scorer. I think with Erling Haaland, we're genuinely seeing something different, possibly something that the Premier League hasn't seen before. I know sometimes there's a bit of, you know, the shiny new toy theory around that, because he's brand new to the Premier League and there was so much hype about him coming, but the type of goals that he scores, the performances that he puts in, I think are at a slightly higher level than Harry Kane. That's not to do Kane down. As I say, he's an excellent player. He's one of the top all-time Premier League goal scorers, despite the fact that he's played less games than some of the names that he's up there with. But Haaland, I think he just strikes fear into defenders in the Premier League, in the Champions League. And Harry Kane can do that, but maybe not to the level that Erling Haaland has done so far. There's still a long way to go. Erling Haaland's played a fraction of the amount of Premier League football that Harry Kane is. But in the here and the now, if I was picking my fantasy football team this weekend, although no hints on that, I'd be going for Haaland over Kane.
Yeah, I can see why as well, to be fair. And I'd be curious to see how Haaland now does fare up against Liverpool. He was rested, of course, last night for that Champions League game. Just speaking of the Champions League, it was I didn't think it was going to be as interesting as it ended up being last night, and Barcelona are the reason for that. They're now on the brink of a group stage exit for the second successive season after their draw last night with Inter Milan.
Yeah, it's a really poor situation that they find themselves in, and this was a crazy game last night where they, at various points, were in front, behind, drawing, then behind again, and then eventually managed to get themselves a point. But they needed to win to keep their destiny in their own hands. And if Inter win one of their final games, one of them's against Victoria Pilsen, who've been whipping boys in Group C, which you'd imagine they'll get, Barcelona are out. And that'd be, as you say, second season in a row for Xavi. And the financial restructuring that's gone on at the club this summer, this will be a big blow for that, because so much of that was levered against them winning a major trophy. This one looks like it's going to be crossed off for this season, and then it's only the domestic title. They've got Real Madrid this weekend as well, which they're not going into that in great form either. So,
How are Real Madrid going into it, though?
I think the difference, or one of the main differences between the two of them, Real Madrid are not as dominant and as forceful as they were last season, but they do what Real Madrid does very well and what Carlo Ancelotti does very well. Even if they're not 100%, if they're 90-95%, they still get their results, they still win their games. They're, I think, if my memory serves me correctly, I think they're already through in the Champions League, so that's already boxed off. Two games to go, they can rest players. I'd fancy Real Madrid to get get the win that they need and put even more distance between themselves and Barcelona, because crises happen at Barcelona. Crises rarely happen, particularly like this at Real Madrid.
Oh yeah, although we would have said that probably about Barcelona in the past as well. And Fergal, very quickly, give me a prediction for Liverpool-Man City.
Score draw. 1-1, maybe 2-2. I'd go 2-2, why not? I don't think Liverpool are capable of keeping a clean sheet at the moment.
True, yeah.
And obviously Haaland for City. So yeah, 2-2, I'll go for.
So 2 for Salah and 2 for Haaland, is it?
possibly.
Fergal, Brennan, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break. Stay with us though, because we're doing rugby with Bernard Jackman next.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to the show. There are some early games in the Europa League, and the one of note is that Arsenal are leading Bodo Glimt 1-0 after 42 minutes. Bernard Jackman is with me in studio. Bernard, let's just go back to the story about Wasps and the fact that they look set to enter administration within days, and they've been suspended from the Premiership. When it comes to players and trying to get new jobs, I know you outlined how difficult it can be for some of them. Who should the provinces here be targeting?
Look, there's not a huge amount. There's obviously strict rules on foreign players for Ireland, and as far as I know, all the provinces have used up their spots. But for me, John Ryan, the tight head prop, you know, bring him home. I think Munster, you saw their scrum last week against Connacht, they got taken apart, and you know, Keelan Knox does need to get some game time. But I think from Munster, if they were to miss out on Europe this year, the knock-on effect of that in terms of financial resources that are going to have available to play or to fund their academy in the future would be detrimental. So I think if he was available, I'd be bringing him back. I don't think you should ever let him go, to be honest. I think it was a poor move. And also with the World Cup coming up, he just gives you another tight end in the country who's at a decent level. So he's the one for me that I think the RFU should be talking to and sending back to Munster. If he wants to come back, obviously.
Yeah, if he wants to come back. I know that often when things like this happen, or you know, there's a blow and a team looks like they could be in trouble, we tend to think about the players and the people working there. What about the fans, though, and the community, the rugby community, that'll be affected?
Yeah, it's going to be huge. Obviously, they lost their old fans, or certainly a large amount of them when they moved to Coventry, and then they did huge work in the community over the last 4 or 5 years to try and build a new fan base. And look, they never really got the numbers that they needed to. Plus, as I said, the stadium, you know, which was being touted as a multi-purpose stadium, you know, revenue 52 weeks of the year, never brought in the type of cash from off-field activities that they expected to. So, but I do feel sorry for the fans. I mean, and same for Worcester fans. Worcester obviously aren't as well known as Wasp, but a proud club, been in the Premiership a long time, and there's some real hardcore fans there. And again, they're caught. Do they go support another club who potentially were enemies, or do they go back to the grassroots rugby? It's very sad. You know, these clubs have been established a long time, a lot longer than professionalism, and effectively, you know, they die. Well, Worcester will pretty much be dead, and we wait to see what happens with Wasps.
Yeah, it's really sad. Like, that's the thing, you know. When you're in the middle of it, you probably think you're invincible, but you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think speaking to some coaches and players, like Worcester, for example, were paid late a few times at the end of last year, and that's a warning sign. Mm. But they believed, you know, they were given all kinds of excuses. They believed this. And you do, but you probably find it hard to see a big club go under. You know, you always think someone's going to come in and buy it.
Mike Ashley.
Yeah, exactly. Or the RFU won't let it go, etc. But no.
Well, that's what I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been, I think, some criticism within the game in England. And the problem as well is that those shares now, so the WAS shares or WAS and Worcester split of the RFU funding will now go to the 10. So effectively, Worcester and WAS going out of business, okay, they'll have to work out how they make up for those extra games. But those 10 clubs that are left, financial kickback from the RFU now increases, if you get me. Mm. So there hasn't been a huge amount of support from the other clubs, from what I can see, which I find a little bit sad and disappointing, and it's not really that you know, the community spirit or spirit that you would maybe like to see. And I know it's dog eat dog and it's professional sport, but I think it's been a very sad couple of weeks for professional rugby.
Yeah, because you think surely the league is stronger with having all of the teams that maybe deserve to be there.
Yeah, you would, you know, absolutely, you would think so. But look, it's what other clubs are doing now is they're snapping up the best talent, and unfortunately, you know, the internationals will get picked up absolutely, but it's the journeyman pros, you know, who haven't done anything wrong. They'll struggle. A couple of players have to sign for Coventry in the Championship, but Championship funding is way down. I think it's going to be another, I suppose, message to players, the importance of preparing for life after rugby. You know, not just true. Even you know, we always thought injury is something that could stop us. But now, you know, the club you play for not being financially viable and going out of business is another reason to be focused on your career post-playing.
Yeah, definitely. The cycle keeps moving, though. That's the thing, you know, and there's always going to be games, and there's plenty of them this weekend, starting with Connacht and Leinster. And good news for Leinster fans that Tadhg Furlong will make an appearance.
Yeah, huge, and I wasn't sure when he was going to come back. I think James Lowe and Gibson Park have muscle injury, so they're not fit or haven't played yet. I understand Jordan Larmour and Will Connor's injuries last week were quite serious, so they may miss some of November. Johnny Sexton played 80 last week, so he's not making the trip, but it's still a very strong team. But yet there's some youngsters like Cormac Foley at 9. He was very impressive last week. He came on at half time. He looked really good last year. He played against Munster and Aviva. And I'm excited to see him. Liam Turner is a player who hasn't had a huge amount of game time. And then, you know, James Ryan comes back in. As you said, Tadhg Furlong comes in. Dan Sheen has been outstanding. Doris is back as well from his little break. And it's still a very strong Leinster team, you know. And yeah, it's going to be interesting how Connacht. I mean, I think Connacht this week, I read David Heffernan's interview, and he said, yeah, we answered questions around us in terms of a four pack, in terms of our physicality. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to have to go again. They're going to have to go up another level, because that Leinster pack, on paper and on kind of what they've been doing over the last 3 or 4 weeks, is a different animal than the Munster pack that Connacht did a job on. So that's going to be huge. You know, 4G pitch, grass pitch, it doesn't matter. These interpros are generally one up front, and I'm down there tomorrow night. I'm really looking forward to it. It was a great atmosphere last week down in Sports Ground. Connacht needed that win. Maybe that'll give them 20% in terms of performance level, but they're going to have to be good to beat this Leinster team.
And I know Andy Friend is in that new role now for a little while. How do you think it's going?
Look, I think they've been, because the 4G pitch, they asked to play their first three games away from home. So they went to Ravenhill. Ulster are in good shape at the moment, particularly if it's not wet. Then they went to South Africa. So probably, being realistic, they were never really going to get anything out of those three games. Maybe a losing bonus point, but they didn't get anything. And that put huge pressure on them to beat Munster. They did. And realistically, look, at the end of the season, there'll be no one crying about losing to Leinster at home, really, you know. So it's probably a freebie for them, but if they could get that win tomorrow night, it would be massive for them, and it would put more pressure on Munster, obviously, for that European spot. But I think I think Andy Friend has effectively been director of rugby anyway. It's a very strong chance he's going home. It's nearly all, but certainly he's gone home at the end of the year. So in the summer, so he's made a big impact at Connacht. And I suppose it gives the Connacht management, you know, the CEO, etc., an opportunity to see, in terms of the coaches who are underneath Andy Friend, you know, who has the ability to step up, or do they need to go and bring in another DOR?
So we're at the stage now where the games are much more competitive, which is exactly where everybody wanted to be with the URC. Although it's probably not great if you're Munster and you have to face the Bulls now this week.
No, it's not. But the Bulls coming off a loss to Edinburgh, where they were quite poor, which was surprising. This is a must win. You know, let's be honest. Munster come to the Aviva next week. Obviously, they'll raise their game. But on form, you don't expect them to win. And then you're around a corner. Then is obviously November and no games. So it's going to be the host Ulster the week after. But these are this weekend against the Bulls is the key match for Munster. If they're to lose that, I think confidence is going to be at a very low ebb. Plus, you're giving a team like the Bulls an away win and they're probably a team you're competing with for, they are a team you're competing with for top eight. So yes, I'd say it's been a big week. The coaches are saying all the right things. I'm sure they're very frustrated. It just hasn't happened on the field yet. And I don't even know if Thomond's going to be that much of an advantage to them, because how many Munster fans are going to come? I don't think fans are going to come from Waterford and Cork or Tipperary, really, given how poorly they've been playing. So you really need that Limerick support to come out and get them over the line by hook or by crook. You know, there wasn't anything flashy about Connacht last week, but they got the 4 points. And I think that's beyond end all for Munster.
And Ulster are taking on the Lions. It feels like it's an exciting time to be an Ulster rugby fan.
Yeah, Ulster 3-4. Just struggled with that power game that Leinster brought in the wet. The Lions have been the surprise package, to be honest. Winning three away from home when they lost most of their best players over the summer has been a big shock. It's at altitude. I think Ulster are good enough. Ulster's attack is very fluid, and I'd be disappointed if Ulster couldn't get an away win there.
Okay, Bernard Jackman, thank you so much for coming in. As always, we'll be talking to you soon. We're going to take a very quick break, but stay with us, Charlene Molesley and Jane Mangan to come.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It is half time in that early Europa League game between Arsenal and Bodo Glimt, and Arsenal are still 1-0 ahead. We're going to turn our attention to athletics now, and I'm delighted to say that Charlene Molesley joins us now on the line. Charlene, how are you?
I'm great, Marie. How are you?
Great. Thanks, William, for coming on. I've been following you for a while and I've never actually got to interview you yet, so I'm delighted to have a chat. So many questions. So, look, this time of year, Charlene, I'm always curious for an athlete. So it's like we're heading into the winter. What are you up to right now?
I suppose right now I'm in the depths of winter training. I'm just kind of back into a routine and, yeah, just working hard. And other than that, I'm just working on a few little campaigns at the moment as well, just to keep myself busy. I'm working with Zambrero Ireland at the moment with World Hunger Day, which is coming up on Sunday. So just keeping myself busy with those sort of things.
Yeah, because it's a difficult life being an athlete, isn't it? It's like you're kind of a little bit isolated, and it's not as straightforward, I'd say, as being in a team sport.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I suppose I'm just blessed to have a really good support team around me, and that's what makes doing the individual sport that bit easier, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So tell me about the last year. How's it been for you? We got to see you on the TV quite a bit at the European Championships, and that it feels like you've really made a lot of progress in the last 12, 18 months.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the last year was pretty successful, definitely, with relay teams, you know, breaking the national record in Munich with the girls, and then being in Oregon for the World Championships, being in the mixed 4x400 meters final was an amazing experience as well. I'd be lying if I said I was completely satisfied with how I performed individually, but you know, a few things set me back, but hopefully this won't happen this year and I'll be ready to go and run faster. So I'm really looking forward to next season already.
So what were the things that set you back then?
I came back from a warm weather training camp and I got a small bit of an injury, but at that time of year it's not really ideal, you know. So I was just kind of fighting between myself with that little thing, and then obviously COVID was rampant, so I was lucky enough to catch that twice.
Oh, no.
On both weeks of nationals. But look, I was still able to perform. It didn't hold me back too much, and look, everyone was kind of dealing with it, so that's what I told myself, that I wasn't really out of luck, that it was just everyone had to deal with it at some time. So like, of course I'm still blessed that I got to be a part of the relay teams this year, and I was fast enough to be on them. So, of course, it was successful, but I was more so content than satisfied, if that makes sense.
You know, it absolutely does. And, like, the thing about athletics that I always find quite interesting is that you're usually judged on medals. You know, the general public are looking to see how you get on and you know, what you're coming away with. But your own standards and goals, I'd imagine, are different.
Yeah, of course. Like, you know, at national level, of course, you want to be winning a medal. You want to be on the podium when it comes to nationals, and that's always the way it is. But, you know, you take those next steps to being at European Championships and being at World Championships. And you see more, like, I've seen more as I get older, you know, what it takes to be on the podium. And I think that we have a great number of athletes. Like, I was Mark and Kira winning medals in Munich this year. It really made us see, well, that could be us, you know, like, especially in the depth that we have in the relay team at the moment. I think if we all work together as a team and push each other on, I think that there's definitely a capability for a medal in the near future.
Yeah, it's exciting. And one of the things that I know you've been working on is the mental side of your game. How do you improve that and how do you build that up?
Yeah, I suppose a lot of it is belief in myself. I obviously have to work with the team around me to make sure that I am able to do that. It's looking back on the hard work that I've already done, you know, something as simple as a training diary so I can actually see the work I've done so I'm not too stressed out when it comes to a competition worrying, am I in shape or not? But also working with a sports psychologist is going to be the next step that I really hope to improve on the mental side of things. But yeah, it definitely has been a struggle for me. But I think every athlete in their own way does struggle mentally. But I just think it's maybe not talking about so much.
Yeah, it's much more of an acceptable topic of a conversation now. It's normal to have a sports psychologist to look for those tools that you need on the big day and every day really just to get up, which is, I'd imagine, just it's something that's really important when you're an athlete.
Yeah, definitely. I think it definitely is more common now. Like when, you know, a couple of years ago, I was like, I don't need a sports psychologist. And the more mature I've gotten in the sports, the more I realise actually you do need these things in place, you know.
And Charlene, look, it hasn't been straightforward and it never is for anyone in sport. Like there's highs and there's lows. And the Olympic Games for you, I guess most people thought you were going to end up there and it didn't work out that way. Can you just tell us a little bit about that time and how you dealt with it?
Yeah, so it was obviously a rough time. Like I still sometimes get emotional speaking about it, but you know, that is part of the sport and there's highs and there's lows. And you know, there was a really rocky 2 weeks that I had after I found out I wasn't going, but I had to brush myself off somehow. So I literally just decided, one of my friends asked me, do you want to go to race in Belgium? And I was like, yeah, of course. So the two of us trotted off, had no expectations whatsoever, ran a massive PB, was the second fastest in Ireland at that time. And I was just like, I was over the moon. And I think the fact that I did that, like, I knew I was capable of it, but it was just producing it. And I think that made me really believe that I can actually keep going, because when something like that really sets you back, like you do question, like, is it pointless to keep going? Like, why am I putting in all of this hard work to, you know, just be shut down? Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that really made me believe in myself. And the support team that I had around me, like with my coaches at that time, like I really couldn't have pushed on if it wasn't for them.
So do you think not being selected that time unburdened you in ways?
I think it really hurt me, but I think it made me a stronger person. You know, like I go to races now and I'm like, what do I have to lose? Because, you know, at the end of the day, selectors are selectors and I can only produce what I can produce. So I have no say in that. So now I just go to a race and I'm like, well, it's my race. It's no one else's. No one else can hamper this, only me. So I just go and I run now and that's that.
Yeah, that's probably not a bad attitude to have for life in general then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, take it on with life as you can. Like, honestly, like everything kind of plays into each other. You know what I mean? It's like with work, it's with sport, it's with everything. Like, you just have to take it one day at a time.
So tell me, what's in store for you now over the next while?
Well, this year, I definitely, you know, I want to get mentally and physically stronger, obviously faster on the track. So that's what we're working over for the next couple of months. And then indoor season will be kicking off around February. So I have a couple more months to train and get prepared for that. So I aim to go to the European Indoor Championship, which will be in March. And then the World Outdoor Championship, which will be in Budapest in August. That's where my real targets are set. I want to be running more consistent than I have been before, because sometimes I run really good and then sometimes it's okay and then really good, and you know, I just much prefer if I went out and I was running similar times across the board as long as they're fast.
Yeah, and look, the thing about it as well, Charlene, you're still so young, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like you're only 23, am I right?
24. Someone actually said the other day, you're in your mid-20s now. I was like, oh my god.
You have a good few Olympic cycles ahead of you is what I'm getting at though, and the next one's going to come around pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Like after this year, like, well, of course, already in my mind is Paris. You know, I want to give it two really good years and give it everything I have. So I never look back when I'm older and say, oh, I wish I tried harder. So I think that's Tokyo. The loss of Tokyo has made me really motivated for Paris. And look, I'll give it everything I have. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But I'd be pretty confident that it will if I give it everything that I have.
Yeah, for sure. Charlene, look, lovely talking to you. As I said, I was looking forward to talking to you at Stumps Stage. I'm delighted we had this chat and no doubt we'll be talking to you again soon sometime.
Oh, thanks a million, Marie. I really appreciate that.
Thanks, Charlene. Talk to you later. So Charlene was speaking ahead of Zambrero, Ireland's first ever meal packaging event, which is taking place on World Hunger Day this Sunday. With the help of over 100 volunteers, Zambrero aims to pack 30,000 nutritious meals, which will be donated to people in need in developing countries. To date, Zambrero has donated 61.5 million meals to people in need all around the world. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us, though. Jane Mangan is next. Now, welcome back to Game On. It is Thursday, but we are doing all of our Friday guests today because tomorrow night we will be playing Europe's biggest dance show here on 2FM. So that means we are treated to Jane Mangan on a Thursday. Jane.
I know, it feels weird, Marie, doesn't it? We just don't know how to handle ourselves on a Thursday.
Don't know what to do. But we have you, so that always helps.
Always helps. It helps when there's good racing to talk about as well. It kind of gets the juices flowing and makes it feel like we have an extra long weekend, even though there's one more day of work before it all actually happens.
Yeah, so it is a big weekend because it is coming up to the last weekend on the flat.
Yeah, the last major weekend, you could say, British Champions Day. It's not, you know, we have Irish Champions Weekend at home. You've Arc Weekend in France. Well, the UK have British Champions Day. They've got six races, four of them at Group 1 level. And I suppose tomorrow it's all about Baid because he's Europe's highest rated horse. I say Europe, thinking the UK is still in Europe. Baid is 10 from 10. He's six-time Group 1 winner and he's the second highest rated horse in the world. He's going into the Champions Stakes tomorrow, having won the QE2 last year. We know this is his swan song. We know this is his last run. So can horses like Adair and Baybridge, My Prospero, get near him? I honestly don't think they can. This guy has been as good as we've seen since Frankel and See the Stars. I don't want to compare them because they're completely different horses in completely different times, but he is a real true champion in his own time, and I'm looking forward to seeing him in the flesh. Having seen him at Ascot, he's an impressive individual, but what he does in performance is even more impressive.
Okay, so that's something to look forward to this weekend, as is the Queen Elizabeth II Stakes.
Yeah, the QE2 is always a good race. It was won last year, as I mentioned, by Baid beating Palace Pier, the Gosdens trained Palace Pier. Well, they'd be hoping that they can get revenge by providing Inspiral with her fourth Group 1 win. She's been lightly raced. We've only seen her three times this year, having been crowned last year's champion two-year-old filly. She'd be very hard to beat. Jadumi, who we saw win at Irish Champions Weekend for the Crisfords, and Modern Games are likely to provide her with the biggest test. The fillies and mares race, big field for that actually, and the Gosdens are well represented here too. They've got Mimic You in the 14 runner race, but more importantly they've got Emily Upjohn. We'll all remember her, apparently very unlucky in the Epsom Oaks. She was shot to the head of the Ark Market after that. God, what an overreaction that was. She hasn't won since, and we haven't seen her since she bottomed out in the King George, but she's got the hood on for the first time and Frankie Dettori back aboard. She'll have to be good to beat last year's winner Eshada. Paddy Toomey saddles Ross Carby and Aidan O'Brien sends Emily Dickinson, but Emily Upjohn should be hard to beat.
Is she as good as everyone thought?
I'm not convinced. She has to go and do it. A little bit like with Baye, the trainer has always said, I don't want to hype him. I want to leave him do the hyping himself. Whereas I think us in the press probably got a bit carried away with Emily Upjohn.
Wouldn't be like you.
Thinking that she might be the next enable.
And just before we finish up, Jane, let's have a word about Holly Doyle. Big weekend for Holly.
Yeah, it's been a huge season for her. She's finishing second to William Buick in the Jockeys Championship. She's had top representation across the board. She's had Group 1 wins and the Platinum Queen there in France, and Trushan has been a flagship horse for her, and she'll be hoping that he can make it a third win in a row in the Long Distance Cup. The first horse that, if he completes the hat-trick, he'll be the first horse to do so on British Champions Day. He's won the last two renewals of this race. He's a top stayer and she gets on very well with him. So Holly's been a flag bearer for British racing really this season. She's everything you'd want in a person and in a professional, and it would be good for her if Trushan won the opening race on Saturday, but it's already been a marvellous season for her.
Great. Jane Mangan, as always, thank you so much. Enjoy the weekend and we will talk to you next week.